Coming up on the next What Difference Does It Make podcast with Holly Cantos and Dave Sloan, it's me, big 80s icon and former MTV VJ Mark Goodman. Don't miss that. Here we go.
Starring...
You'd think I would know how to use Zoom by now.
Look at you.
Okay, he has a way better mic than we do.
He better.
He sounds so much better.
Come on.
It's like you're a professional.
Let's go. Step into the 90s.
Yeah, I know. Right.
How are you guys?
No, we're stuck in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're, okay. We're I tell everyone, we're legally obligated to stay in the 80s. We can't venture out.
Fair enough. I believe me, I, you know, spiritually, so am I.
Yeah. How much time do we have with you, sir?
I have a meeting at 2:00. So like 5 of or so, 10 of.
We can join you in the meeting. That's fine.
Oh, you would not want to. Although it might be fun. Actually, we're going to be picking our top 5 for next week. That's a fun thing to do.
Oh, okay.
Oh, fun.
Spoiler alert. Yeah. What do we got in your top 5? Let's go into the now. Talk your top 5.
We do I'm on Big 80s on Sirius XM, but I'm also on another channel called Volume, which is a talk channel about music. It's like political radio or sports talk, but about music. And I co-host a live show every afternoon. Right now it's 5 to 7. So every Tuesday, Top 5 Tuesday. This week, Tim and Faith's anniversary. So because of that, we did top 5 couples in music.
I'm trying to think of some happy couples that are still together and still kicking.
Well,
who
I don't know if it's a spoiler now because we didn't do it yesterday. So now I'm going to hold on to it. But I can tell you that one of mine was not Sonny and Cher, although first to mind for me on a top 5.
Really? I don't know. But that ended in divorce. Actually, Sting and Trudy, they're still together. So that's a...
You know what? I didn't even think about Sting and Trudy.
What?
That's a really good one. Yeah. That's a really good one.
So I'm going to go to the other end of the spectrum and go with Gwen and Blake.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there were those who were talking about Gwen and Gavin.
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Actually,
oh, yeah.
The classic ones are the ones that ended divorce. I mean, Cher and Greg Allman, that's a classic get together right there as well.
What I was thinking about doing was Cher and Gene Simmons, Cher and Sonny, Cher and Greg Allman,
yeah.
Right? Cher and whoever she's with now, if she's with anybody now.
Bagel Boy. Remember Cher and Bagel Boy?
Oh, Bagel Boy, right. I knew there was one just like a person who wasn't famous or anything
right.
She was with. I was going to do those. I opted out of that. I know what my number 5 was.
Okay.
And this would be, let me think here. Is it, well, this would be one of 2 that are not still together on my list. My number 5 was Sid and Nancy.
Oh,
very good.
Whatever happened to those kids, those crazy kids?
Whatever happened to them? They were so cute.
They were adorable.
How about James Taylor and Carly Simon?
How about them?
Oh, that there you go.
How about them?
Wow, I want to play.
Didn't make it either.
Oh, I was going to say I want to play poker with you because it seems like that's on the list by your reaction.
Mostly, I have people who are together, who are stayed together. But I had to. I'll just tell you, like who knows when we're going to do this one. But my favorite, you know, couple that is not together, but musically one of my favorite collaborations is Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just a major, major fan of them. I was a fan of theirs when they were a duo. So they were my number 1.
Actually, you could probably do top 5 of all Fleetwood Mac relationships.
Easily.
All within the band. That's a whole other ball of wax. Okay, we're not here to talk about top 5 rock couples. We're here to talk to Mark Goodman. I looked up this guy on IMDb, and the first sentence, besides his birth date, which I now have, it says that he is known for his work. This is the first sentence. He is known for his work on Police Academy 6, City Under Siege, where he played businessman number 2. So, of course, we are talking about Mark Goodman. Hey!
I know. Everybody
welcome.
Remembers me for that role.
Welcome, businessman number 2.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank
you.
We're so happy to have you.
Yeah. You'll be happy to know he's not even sitting on a, he never sits on a chair. I think he's always sitting on like a desk or something, because that's what he did at MTV. I never saw him sit in a chair. He's always like, oh, I'm so cool. I'm sitting on a desk. I'm, you know, legs folded.
We were breaking all the rules, you know.
That's right. That's what it was. It was breaking the rules. Well, then let's go back to your WMMR days. What were you listening to back then?
Disco.
Yeah. Okay.
Really?
I really love dance music. I love EDM to this day. I was working at a rock and roll station. It was kind of strange. And Steve Dahl was in Chicago doing, Death to Disco Day and burning piles of disco records and stuff. But I was, you know, I'd play great rock and roll at WMMR. And then, you know, I'd go out. I went to see plenty of concerts, plenty of rock and roll shows for sure. But I love that, the dance music too. I listened to the stuff that was happening that day. I happened to really like what was happening in punk. I wasn't a huge fan of the Sex Pistols, but I understood it. I didn't think that we should be playing the Pistols on MMR at the time, because we were very much into, you know, being that sort of corporate rock station, and, you know, we were carrying a certain flag. But AC/DC also really started to happen around that time, 76, 77, yeah. You know, and that was
and back.
What we needed.
They're back again. New song.
I can't even believe that.
With the band, with Phil Rudd on drums, and that's just the way we want it.
So glad he got out of jail.
Yeah, I know.
So nice to see him back. it's all right.
Yeah, it is all right. I love it. We love talking about like first album purchases, first concerts. What were you into as a kid? Like, you know, 11, 12, when did you first discover the music that you started to get into?
Well, being born in 1995, and also, wait, what? 87.
I have the paperwork here, sir.
Yeah. Let's put it this way. I mean, I remember seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and that was a game changer moment for me. So, but in those days, and I was probably 10 or 11 or something like that when they were on, I don't remember exactly, but I know that with pretty shortly after that, me and my friends really got into soul music, Motown, what was coming out of Memphis. I saw Otis Redding. I saw James Brown. You know, I was living in Philadelphia, so all that sounds of Philadelphia, you know, the Stylistics and the Intruders and all of that stuff, that's where I grew up listening to. That's the radio that I was listening to in the early and mid 60s. You know, James and Bobby Purify, and obviously Smokey and the Temps and all of that stuff. That was really my music, and I started to sort of go to the dark side and listen to more rock and roll towards the latter part of the 60s, sometime around Creamed Israeli Gears, which was, I guess, 67 ish.
Did you have a radio station back then to discover this stuff?
No. Yeah, in my bedroom.
Well, okay, so this just word of mouth? Was it friends? Like, how'd you find Cream, you know?
Well, in Philadelphia, I mean, Philly, I got to say, Philly was a great, great music town. It just was open to new music and to new artists and to new forms. It was, you know, there was WNEW in New York and KSAN in San Francisco. They were the first quote unquote progressive stations. Mm-hmm. And WMMR was part of that chain, that company. Mm. But before, you know, the soul stuff, I was listening to AM radio. It was WDAS AM and WHAT AM. And I used to cut school when I was in junior high and go on. Georgie Woods, who was a DJ on WHAT, also had a dance show on UHF, Channel 17.
Nice.
It was 17 Canteen. And I used to cut school and go on that show and dance. And
did you?
That's where I was finding a lot of stuff. And then it was, you know, underground radio that came up in Philadelphia, WDAS FM and WMMR, which was, except for 4 hours of the day, was a classical music station. And 10 to 2 at night, they played rock music. Nice. And that's where I started to really get turned on to stuff.
Wasn't Bandstand in Philly originally? Was it still during in the 60s? It was
Well, I forget exactly when they went to California, but yeah, they were in a, you know, the arena, which was this crappy, you know, hall on Market Street. And in fact, years later, I went and saw like wrestling matches there.
Nice.
But yeah, the American Bandstand, huge. But so was, you know, we had a lot, there was stuff like in Atlantic City. What was it? I can't even remember the guys' names, but they had, you know, dance shows that came to you on TV from the Steel Pier in Atlantic City. And they would have, you know, bands on like Bandstand did. They'd have bands on lip syncing to their current mm-hmm. songs and stuff. So yeah, Philly was a great, great music town. It really was. I'm glad I got to grow up there.
Did you ever dance on any of those shows?
Bandstand, no. That one, I was a little young for their heyday in town. And I think that they were gone, but I wasn't into dancing in like 67, 68, 69, you know, when I started to get into the psychedelic stuff and you know, blues rock and stuff like that. So I wasn't quite the dancer. That took a little while.
Apparently from your book, there were other influences that stopped you from dancing. Apparently you had a side business that was kind of slowing down your movements.
Man, sped it up actually.
Oh, sped it up. Right. I'm sorry. I have never taken any of those. So I'm yeah.
Yeah. Stern, man. Stern read the book. He had us on when the book came out and he was fascinated by the fact that I was a drug dealer.
My chin literally dropped like, oh my, this can't be this guy.
You were so matter of fact about it,
right?
You know, at this point, I don't know. I guess seeing the way that people reacted to it later on, even in the 70s and stuff, and I got long away from that stuff. But I guess it was a little crazier than I imagined it at the moment.
Sure. What do you know? You're just a kid. You're just everyone's doing it. All the cool kids are taking.
I wanted to buy more records. I wanted to have a better stereo system. You know,
it's a business.
It's a business venture. So yeah, it was me and a friend of mine, and we got into the business, and it worked out great.
Well, not just a business.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a natural movement to if I can't do this anymore, let's go to radio because that you know, perhaps that's a cleaner business maybe. In the early 70s.
That thank God radio existed because I have no discernible skills, so I have no idea what the hell I would have done.
So how did you fall into radio? What was your first gig?
The very first gig that I had, I interned at two stations simultaneously in Philly when I went to Temple University. And one of them was an AM station, WFIL. It was a top 40 station. And I was there during the day. And it was it was like 75. And I was there during the day doing what has now come to be called phone out research. I was tasked with playing little snippets of songs to listeners and getting their reactions and, you know, that kind of thing. And they bought the radio station that was owned by the Philadelphia Bulletin, the biggest newspaper in Philadelphia. And they turned it into this really weird, interesting hybrid of adult contemporary, so that we played, you know, sort of, you know, Beth and from Kiss, and but we also played like Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett and stuff like that. And it was some country stuff we worked in there. So that was my first gig, Friday and Saturday overnight, midnight to six.
That's the best gig.
My first gig. Yeah. And the Saturday night one, pretty soon after I got that gig, I got another one in Allentown, which is about an hour north of Philadelphia, an AM station, but it was a freeform AM station. And I started doing afternoon drive there. I was on 2 to 6 there. So I would stay up there a couple of days a week and then drive to Philly on Friday after doing that show on Friday. Wow. And go on at midnight on Friday night into Saturday morning and then sleep all day Saturday and then go in at midnight on Saturday night. That shift was a tough one. I was on midnight to 4. And then at 4, I had to run religious tapes. So the first one was an hour, 4 to 5. And that was tough, like to make it through that hour, just sitting there doing nothing. And then there were 2 30-minute tapes. And one morning, I'll never forget the guy who was coming on after me at 6 a.m. Sunday morning, walking into the studio. And there I am with my head on the desk, asleep.
Of course.
And he was like, I was driving in. I haven't heard anything on the air for the last half hour. What's going on?
Whoops.
You know, the first 30 minutes ran out and I didn't notice. So yeah, that's what my first gig was like. I can't believe I continued.
Do you still have those nightmares? Because that seems like every jock has that, like waking up in the middle of the night.
It's so funny that you say that. You know about that? You know about these crazy nightmares? Yeah. I do still have those distress dreams. I have, and I literally have had them within the last bunch of weeks, and it's weird because this technology is not existent anymore, but I have dreams of either not, my record that's on the air is running out and it's fading. And I can't get the next record queued up. I can't queue it up and get it on and it's fading and I can't get it and it's fading. Or it's fading, and I can't find the next record that I want to play. And it's fading, and it just goes on and on and on. And it's a horrible nightmare. But I guess I'm progressing because I literally have just had a phone call, a nightmare about phone calls and how I was on the air on my live show and no one was calling.
like having a party and no one showing up.
Just awful. Just awful.
We're having some fun digging into Mark Goodman's neuroses. We promise we will be right back.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Told you we'd be back. Here we are. Welcome to the What Difference Does It Make podcast with Mark Goodman.
I just want to ask you a question because you mentioned Freeform. One of your gigs was at a Freeform station. And I have always wondered this, and I wondered this about Jim Ladd also. How
My
you
buddy.
Go. We love Jim Ladd. Big fans. How you go from Freeform to the corporate environment and being a little bit more boxed in.
Yeah, it was... It was a radical change. MMR, when I started at MMR, it was Freeform. I was hired by the guy who founded the Freeform format at MMR in Philadelphia. He just passed away a few months ago, Jerry Stevens. And so for the first, whatever it was, year, I guess, that I was there, it was Freeform. Then Jeff Pollack came in. Jeff, who is now a major, I guess he's a consultant, but he has branched out of radio, I think, into television and movies and stuff. But he came in. This was his first gig after leaving a big radio chain. And we were going up against WYSP in Philadelphia, which was the Superstars format, the Beatles, the Who, Led Zeppelin, the Stones. Done. That's all you play. So we went up against them, and man, he locked it down. And I happened to be on vacation when he took over, and I literally came back to the studio and like 2/3 of the library was gone from the air studio. Yeah. And I went on the air and I was like, wow, I'm so glad to get back from vacation. See a lot of records missing from the studio. I'm not sure what's happening here. And Jeff was out to dinner with Meg Griffin.
Yeah.
Who I'm not sure if you guys know Meg Griffin. She's pretty much a legend in New York radio and almost was an original MTV VJ.
Yeah.
And Jeff was out with her to dinner. And Meg told me later that he was listening while they were at dinner. And I said that and he goes, I'm going to fire that guy. So he didn't, as it turns out. But yeah.
Well, okay. So for some people, explain Freeform Radio. Explain, like, what was your shift like? 4 hours. What did you get to do during your Freeform shift?
It was really about crafting. It wasn't about hit song, hit song, hit song, or familiar song, familiar song, familiar song. It was about creating a mood. So I would think in terms of 30-minute blocks or 60-minute blocks. And all of my time off the air was spent thinking about segues. You know, what sounds good going from one to the next? What kind of a journey can we craft? Or just what, you know, what's going to sound cool together? And that's what it was about. And it was hard, but it was why I got into radio.
Mm-hmm. It's like art. It's
For sure.
You know, you mentioned Jim Ladd. Yeah. Jim is still doing it. I work with him at SiriusXM. God bless that man. He is still doing Freeform Radio. The only other person who has been able to maintain it to some degree is Meg Griffin. She also still on SiriusXM, but on one of our satellite, on one of our internet channels, and she's still doing it on Disorder. But I don't know anybody else.
It is still fun to listen to. That gets a little when you get used to listening to corporate radio, it gets a little out there.
Yeah, I think it's hard to determine now if it would, for years and years after the death of Freeform, I thought people would still want this. People would still be interested. Now I just don't know. I mean, on the one hand, I think they really would love it because what is, you know, Spotify? Just anything you want in any order you want at any time.
Yeah.
And so you think, well, that would mean maybe people are more open to hearing new music. I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah. The Loft was kind of a Freeform format for a while. They kind of put it out. It's on the internet now. It's not on their main, you know, channels spectrum.
That was, you know, the people who run SiriusXM, the radio people who are involved. This is after Mel Karmazin, who was our GM for quite a while. After that, you know, the people involved in the programming aspects are old school radio people. So they really have that sort of sensibility, a hit sensibility to a great extent, and a rotation sensibility on every one of the channels, whether it's the Broadway channel or, you know, Lithium. Yeah. It doesn't matter. And so it's kind of a different philosophy there. And I think that that's why they moved the Loft. I mean, it's still available. It's questionable. I don't know how, it's so weird to think about how people listen these days. You know, I don't know I can't even predict what it is that's on their minds. I have no idea.
I don't think there is any average listener. Is that what you're saying? What people are, you know, what they gravitate to or how they listen?
I mean, yeah. And pop music is more popular now than ever. Obviously hip hop as which is blended into pop now is the most popular music form. It's the most influential music form. It used to be rock. Yeah. you know, those people on the one hand, they want to hear Camila Cabello and they, you know, they want to hear something new from Rihanna and get off the Fenty thing and give us some new music. So in on the one hand, I think, yeah, they are open to new stuff because there was a moment when Rihanna was brand new and she blew up. I don't know. I mean, we do things on the Volume channel that we try and sort of test the waters. We do a song of the day every day. We do new music Friday. We've started doing this battle where my co-host, Alan Light, who is a great music journalist and author, we each pick a song, play it in full, which we're not allowed to do on that channel, except rarely because it's a money issue, you know, publishing. Mm-hmm. But so we do that and battle it out and see what people think about the various songs, and we are often surprised at the responses. I can't predict. Who knows?
Okay, so let's go back to the first days of MTV, because that was what everybody wanted to hear, apparently. That's what we were all waiting for. Was that your thinking, like, this, people are going to just love this so much?
Yeah, I believe that, and not as much as I would have imagined. Who knew that it was going to become a cultural icon? I had no idea about that. But when, you know, I forget if this is in the book or not, but literally within a month of my getting hired, and I was hired a few months before we launched, I wrote a 4-page memo because I had been a programmer, you know, I was a music director. I mean, I had been working at PLJ in New York. I wasn't the music director there, but you know, I had my take on programming. I wrote this memo about who our audience was and what they would like and this and that. I quit PLJ, the number one rock and roll station in New York, to go to this who knew what it was going to be cable station, cable TV station playing videos. I figured it's going to be around. It, you know, how bad can it be? It's people watching videos. I knew videos. I was going to host a video show in Philadelphia before I moved up to New York. So I thought, I was looking for the new underground. Where's the next underground coming from? And I figured, well, that's probably a good place. I was done with, no offense to anybody, I was done with Meatloaf. I was done with Boston. I was done with that stuff. Now let's do something else. And just by default, as I'm sure you know, I mean, the reason that we were so progressive was because we didn't have any freaking videos.
Yeah. We know now.
Right now, you know. Although, it was just the Brits who were well-schooled in video that were doing it. So that's what we played mostly.
It was all Rod Stewart all the time, though.
Yeah. We played Rod Stewart like mad. We had like 9 Rod Stewart videos and in a total of like 300 videos. So we saw a lot of Rod Stewart. We played a lot. Andrew Gold. Very big in the early days, Andrew Gold. But we also had, you know, like the Producers. And, you know, we had Robin Lane and the Chartbusters.
Yeah.
These are, there's like 4 people listening right now who are going, oh, I think I remember them.
We actually did an episode on like the first 25 songs that MTV played. And it was like, do you remember this song? Do you remember this thing? Oh, look, here's Rod Stewart again. Oh, another Pat Benatar. Okay.
Oh, God, yes.
It's Past the Buggles, not the public doesn't necessarily remember.
Well, yeah, right. I've used that at gigs as a trivia question. What was the second song that MTV played?
Yes, exactly. That's good.
I can't go past number 2. I don't know what the third one was. You know, no idea. I do know the first 2 now.
I'm kicking myself because I was about to print out the list. I don't have that with me.
Can you tell us number 2? Because I can't remember, even though we...
You Better Run, Pat Benatar.
First song.
Aldo is quick to point out that song, coming second on MTV, that song was the first rock song played and the first guitar heard on MTV, his guitar.
Yeah. That's
true. He made a point of letting me know that.
Okay. And who's...
That isn't his only claim to fame.
Well, yeah. He's got a couple other things.
So looking back, it's obvious that the Buggles' Video Killed the Radio Star. Oh, my God. This is why I wasn't on MTV. It's obvious that that should have been the first song. But who came up with that idea? Like this is it.
Of the song? I think it was Pittman.
Okay.
Pittman did it. Bob Pittman. I understand. Which I was impressed because he was a top 40 programmer and that song was a couple of years old and it tanked. Mm-hmm. Tanked big time. I mean, the Buggles, when it came out, I was still in Philadelphia. We didn't play that record.
Yeah.
It was like the Buggles. We didn't play Duran Duran either.
Can you name the first song played on VH1?
Mm.
Yeah.
No.
It was Marvin Gaye's Star Spangled Banner.
Really?
From the All-Star game. Yeah, from the NBA All-Star game.
I only vaguely remember some of the, like, I guess Don Imus was a VJ on there, wasn't he, for a little bit? People couldn't go near his little closet where he recorded, from what I remember.
Is that right?
He was so feisty, nobody wanted to go near him.
I remember that. Wow.
Well, okay.
Rosie O'Donnell.
Yeah, that's right.
One of the VJs, yeah.
So what were your sessions like? Was this your first time on TV? Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Did you have any guidelines, or they just said, look, here's the red light. Make sure you're looking at the red light, or.
They didn't even say that.
Okay.
It was like, there's the studios at 33rd and 10th. Have fun. That was it. You know, show up, do it. We were going through run throughs for weeks and weeks before we launched. We were doing pre-recorded interviews and things like that before we launched. But nobody knew what a VJ was. Nobody knew what a VJ was supposed to do. And we all were just trying to figure it out. You know, the funny thing, when I look at the tapes from like the first couple of months, the set looks bare. I mean, it was supposed to look like some loft where the five of us lived. You know,
like the monkeys or something.
But I look at it now and it was barren. I mean, there was like a bike leaned up against the wall and that was it. And over time we gussied it up quite a bit and put a lot more stuff in there, made it a little more sort of homey. I noticed once we came on in Manhattan, which was a year into us broadcasting, we weren't on in Manhattan. So the five of us weren't able to watch MTV for the first year. People in New Jersey and on Long Island and all around us were seeing it. So we didn't, it's hard to imagine if you're just doing the wraparounds, you know, we didn't see the videos. We were just doing our segments. And once it came on, I kind of noticed that it felt like everything came to a screeching halt for our segments. Cause you come out of these videos there was all kinds of stuff going on and explosions and actors and makeup and lighting and slow motion. And there we were. And so I came up with the idea of moving in some way when they came to me in the studio. And I did that for a while. And some of the others, I think, started to do it as well. And then I started to notice, well, crap, it looks like I'm running all over the set. What am I running all over the place for? So that was just one of the things that we tried to figure out, you know, how do we make our segments interesting enough? How do we integrate into the hour? How do we relate to the audience? And I was used to relating to a microphone. I had to learn to relate to a camera, and it's different. It is different. I look at some of those old ones. I'm like, open your eyes. Everybody thought I was high all the time. I was never, ever once high on the air on MTV, ever.
Really?
Never.
What?
I couldn't.
That is not the Mark Goodman that you portrayed in your book.
I never said I was high on the air.
Not on the air.
Okay.
Not that I was never high.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It was the off hours. And the book really put it in context. It was really, you know, Dave and I were probably the average MTV viewer, although we might have known a little more and maybe been a little more into music. But to hear you guys describe it, the segments were so short. You know, we're picturing you, like you said, it was said in the book how you didn't have the videos. Nobody was able to watch the videos. So you were just coming in and out of the videos, as you said. We're assuming you're there and you're watching the whole thing and you're right there, you know, you're right there with us. But the way you guys all described your segments as being so short, like you could get through a shift in, you know, in less than an hour.
Right.
You know,
right.
that was eye opening, you know, because that wasn't at all how we saw it.
Right. That was the difficulty. And the first time for me and for JJ, who had also come from radio, the first time that we kind of had to act. Really, you know, if you're coming out of like this great rocket video, you got to be up just like you would be on the radio if you were coming out of that song.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, what we're coming out of is basically dead silence and a couple of cameramen staring at you and a stage manager, you know. So we really had to amp it up to make it sort of work. It's weird.
Well, you did good. We never would have known.
Yeah. There you go.
Do you remember you probably do, the first time someone stopped you on the street and said, I know who you are. Usually you remember the first time.
I do. It took a while. Like I said, it's the weirdest thing because MTV started to blow up really quickly in other parts of the country. Cheyenne, Wyoming, I did an appearance there within the first 6 months. And I was in the car. They were taking me to this record store where I was going to make an appearance. And they come around the corner in Cheyenne, and there's like 1,000 people over there. And I'm like, wow, who's here? And the driver goes, you are. I'm like, what? It was freaking weird to do that. Well, I'm sorry, what was your question?
Just a little, how much they love you.
Early days being recognized. The best one, though, we had to take cabs to the office, just hail cabs. We were all in New York, and our studio was in New York. And I was late for the studio one day, and I came running out of my apartment, and I hailed a cab really quickly, and I jumped in. And I said, really quick, I'm kind of late. Can you get down to 33rd and 10th? And the cab driver looks in the mirror, and then he turns around, and he goes, hey, Mark, don't worry. If you're late, they'll just play Thriller one more time. And we were showing this, 15-minute Thriller thing, And that was when it really started to hit me.
Yeah.
We would, like, for the first year, nobody knew us in Manhattan. And then we'd go to New Jersey to concerts in New Jersey, and we'd be mobbed. Or on Long Island. Right. We'd be mobbed. It was a strange...
It was like radio. Yeah. You were the jock in Cheyenne or, Fort Lee. Yeah. They knew you in just that little area for a time.
Yeah, that's the other thing. The national celebrity was something else, too, yeah.
But that kind of leads to the I Want My MTV campaign. How markets jumped onto that, how people were actually calling to say I want my MTV.
Really, really smart. That was a good one. I always loved that campaign. I mean, I don't know how, well, if you saw the docs or read the book, Dale Pond, who was the I Want My Maypo guy, Maypo, the child's cereal, the hot cereal, he was the guy who came up with that. Mm-hmm. He just swapped out Maypo for MTV. And the rest is rock history.
I don't know at the moment how it's going to go over, but right. You're able to get, all the artists to do it.
And that is also, and one of the great things I think in the doc is where, Les Garland, who was really the spirit of MTV in a lot of ways, was able to pull in these amazing people like Mick Jagger. He paid Mick $1 to do a promo for us.
That's brilliant. Amazing. And it was kind of like a radio station in that you had these kind of fun contests. Of course, there's the Lost Weekend with Van Halen. Were you any part of that at all?
No, I was not part of that one.
Good call.
And somebody who just called me the other night on my talk show said that I haven't seen the doc. There's apparently a documentary on that, which I have not seen.
I pulled up a small YouTube clip of this guy who won the contest on stage in, it was Detroit. He's in Detroit and they present him with a cake and then throw it in his face.
But I did some of the other promotions. We had a series of promotions called MTV One Night Stands, where if you won that, wherever you were in the country, we would come and pick you up in a Learjet and then fly you somewhere else to see a band. You go back, meet the band, hang out backstage, and then get back on the plane, and we'd have you back home at like 6 in the morning. And so I did that one with the Stones in New Orleans, which was pretty amazing. Alan Hunter got to do all the good stuff, man. He was the guy who did all the spring break stuff. Because he was like the funny VJ, so he got to do that.
Did you guys
stuff actually fun? Was it as fun as it
Alan?
Looked?
Alan had a good time, but Alan, like, he also did Amok in America. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Amok in America, 30 days on the road with phoning in reports from all over the country, and I wanted to do it. Alan, I was married at the time, but so was Alan. But Alan literally. His wife had a baby and he left. Down in spring break things, that was still going on. He had a young child and he'd be, with all these bikini babes and everybody getting hammered and all that. And his wife would be at the back of the crowd holding their baby up, waving, remember, you're a daddy. So it was less than the fun that it could have been, I think, for Alan.
Bad timing.
Yeah.
Did you guys all have nicknames or was there, I don't know. Everyone's known that you said Alan Hunter was the fun one and Martha Quinn was the perky one. Who was Mark Goodman?
We didn't have I was the obnoxious one.
Oh, okay. Good. Good.
We didn't have nicknames for each other, except I used to call JJ Clubman.
Because
that man moved from California, moved from LA to mm-hmm. New York to do this gig. And he made use. He was a single man and a good looking guy. Yeah. And he made use of New York City. He would often roll into the studio after being out all night. And he was the one who first turned me on to using Preparation H under your eyes to get rid of the bags.
I read that in the book. Really? And I thought, wow, if I had only known that.
That's hilarious.
Hell yeah.
That's a
lifesaver.
That's a thing.
You have to admire that. You know, it's like embracing life. Hey, you know,
I mean, my hero for a lot of things. He was amazing.
He was so great. We loved listening to him here too when he was on the air in LA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I miss him all the time. The four of us, you know, we're obviously still in touch and still friends. And, you know, it's one we haven't really gotten past. Mm-hmm. We really feel bad that he's not around here to like, it's the 40th coming up next year.
Yeah.
You know, I wish he would have been around for that one. We really thought that he would be. Not to end on a bummer note.
I know.
Somehow this happens to us.
Right? I know. We end on the bummer.
Yeah.
All right. Was your wife Carol Miller on NEW at the time? Were you? Because were you?
My wife Carol Miller was still on PLJ.
Oh, she. Okay. Time. Oh, okay. That's where you met her?
Which is where, I mean, she and I sort of flitted around each other. She went to University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, and her first radio jobs were on WMMR.
Oh,
and that was where I first heard her. And yes, she was, we were married. No, 1980, we weren't married yet, but we were living together and she was still on PLJ.
Yeah. Your description upon meeting her was very sweet, I thought, in the book.
What did I say?
You just said some very nice, you know, almost like she was a goddess just to.
Yeah, she was a legend really to me. In Philadelphia, she was, I mean, there were it was Allison Steele here in New York and Tom Donahue's wife, Rachel Steele.
Oh, Rachel. Yeah. Rachel Donahue, as we
Rachel
know
Donahue,
her.
Rachel Donahue, not Steele. Yes. There's another one, Rachel Steele. Rachel Donahue, yeah, in San Francisco. And Carol.
Mm-hmm.
And she in Philly, she was like voted the sexiest woman in Philadelphia and won Philadelphia Magazine. And, you know, she was really well known and really was, she was gorgeous. And I was struck for sure, especially because she knew music inside out. It was great.
Yeah. It's very good. Yeah. When I lived in New York, that was the first voice I heard was Carol Miller. When I lived it, I heard her on NEW in 87, yeah. I think it was. And like,
yeah.
Oh, here's someone that's going to be my good friend. I can tell. all right. Before we wrap it up.
Oh my God.
I know. Right. So one of our sponsors that we did a long time ago was for the 80s cruise. And you went on, you did this 80s cruise in March. We were terrified of the people who were on this cruise. What?
Right. I'm pretty badass, right?
Tell me, how terrified were you at this and everyone? What was the situation like there on this
cruise? We would like a vivid description. Yeah. Please.
Well, clearly not terrified enough.
Yeah.
I went.
Yeah.
You know, when we left, which was March the 7th, yeah, we knew about it and there was stuff, but there was people talking about cruises and they were going to, you know, probably maybe stop cruises, might not be a good, but hey man, it's a big gig for me. And I wanted to do it and the lineup was great. And you know, my wife and I, she came with me, she was hesitant, but the cruise line was amazing and promised us, there was no masks yet. Social distancing, right. That wasn't in effect yet. So we were just all there. What I did was wash my hands. Like they had people before you walked into a restaurant, there was somebody there with a squirt bottle for you. And you could see them wiping down railings and doorknobs. I mean, they really, really worked hard. And I just didn't hug anybody for pictures. I didn't get kissed or kiss, you know, I just kept my distance and I made it through without getting sick and nobody on the boat got sick. So we docked on the 15th, Sunday, the 15th, the 16th, everything went into lockdown. Mm-hmm. And on that day, I started to see on the 80s cruise Facebook page, I just tested positive for COVID and I'm getting sick. And then two people, then 10, then 50, and even more so amazing that somehow we didn't get sick. And I was hanging out with Terry Nunn from Berlin, and she didn't get sick. None of us got sick, as far as I know. I think it was, you know, this cluster of passengers. Nobody, as far as I know, nobody died. Everybody is okay. And everybody, amazingly, there is no 2021 cruise. Not amazing. Pushed to 2022, and it is nearly sold out. What they tell me.
Of course.
Go figure. But there's still room for you.
I know. Here you go. I know.
We've been discussed at length.
We were pimping that ride for a while. And we're like, what are we doing sending these people on this boat?
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's great. I'm glad to hear that went well.
So we'll look forward to 2022.
Yes. Yes.
One day we're going to see a show live somewhere in 20.
Those wound up being my last concerts.
Yeah, I know.
Before the lockdown. So, you know, it was Berlin and the Motels and Taylor Dane and Kool and the Gang. It turns out to be really, you know, mm-hmm. Kool and the Gang. That was probably one of their last gigs.
Right.
If not the last gig.
Yeah.
So.
You're depressing me, Mark. You're bringing me down. For someone with such a nice smile, I can't believe you're talking death and disease. What's wrong with you? Anyway, this has been it's been a lot of fun here. I'm glad we had some time with you. I love it.
Thank you so much. This has been so great. And thanks for being flexible with us.
All good.
For sure.
All good. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so you could hear Mark on Volume. What is it? What were the times?
It's SiriusXM Volume. It's channel 106, and I'm on there from 4 to 7 p.m. Eastern live, and on the Big 80s mornings, mostly 7 to 10, and then I do a couple hours in the afternoon at varying times between 6 and 8 in the evening.
Still doing East the Spectrum Coast. At all? Do I hear you at all?
When I took the live show on, I dropped the Spectrum and it killed me. Yeah. I adore the Spectrum to this day. I really do.
Yeah. I also want to add that some of the material from Volume Debatable is also on demand.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
It's all on demand. It's all there.
Could always
Thanks
hear Mark.
Thanks for pointing that out, Holly.
You're very welcome.
She's good with that. All right. So thank you so much, Mark. We'll see you soon. I hope to see you in a club somewhere. You know.
Me too.
Yeah.
On a cruise.
On a cruise. Yeah.
on a cruise or in a club, either one.
Sharing a drink.
I'll take it. Thanks, you guys.
All right. We'll take care, Mark. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.
See you around.
Cheers.
Cheers. Mark Goodman. Very cool. Thank you so much, Mark, for taking the time out to meet with us and talk with us and share some laughs. This is a good send-off, our final interview for this year. Even though we're very happy to end this year, we were very happy that we got the chance to talk with Mark. We had referred to this book. It's called VJ, The Unplugged Adventures of MTV's First Wave. It's a great read. We also mentioned a documentary that's available on A&E. I believe you can still view that on demand. So check that out. Got some contests going on. I would recommend going to our website, wddimpodcast.com/contests, and see what we've got going on. We are a proud member of the Pantheon Network family. So until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's fantasypoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. Fantasypoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.